in fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
CRIMEWAV. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Consider yourselves warned.
Phoenix Nightlife by Jason Duke, Part 3. 11:41 p.m. Chuck had taken a beating for the Chernobyl coke. "You sure you don't want to come?" Tony said to Chuck. He helped Chuck navigate through the parked cars in the parking lot out front of River City Pockets. They walked over to Tony's dark blue metallic 1988 Corvette with tinted windows. "I just want to get home," Chuck palmed Tony the bullet. "Here, have fun." The skinheads had laid into Chuck good. They busted his nose, split open his bottom lip. Some of them had tried to wrestle the bullet from his clenched fist, but he didn't let go. "Sure, you got it," Tony said. Chuck had curled into a fetal ball, and the skinheads thumped into his back with their straight-laced Doc Martens. All the skins had white laces, except the skin with the SS Totenkopf tattooed on the nape of his neck. He wore red laces. "I heard this place is off the hook," Tony said. He opened the driver door to the Corvette, falling into the black leather seat. "I'll fill you in tomorrow with all the gory details." It wasn't until the owner and a few of his biker buddies heard the mirror shatter in the bathroom that they rushed in to see what was going on. They broke up the blitzkrieg, yelling at the skins to get the fuck out of the pool hall. SS Totenkopf kicked Chuck in the nuts, did a Sieg Heil Nazi salute, and walked out. "Okay, see you tomorrow, buddy," Chuck said. Tony shut the door and rolled down the window. "Go home, get some rest, lick your wounds, smoke a joint. Shit, smoke two joints. Tomorrow's another day." 11:46 p.m. Detective Hauenzer picked a half-filled bottle of conditioner from the empty bottles crammed on top of the dresser. He thought about San Diego. He had worked a string of gang-related homicides 2 years ago that had sent him over the edge, enough to quit the SDPD and transfer to Phoenix a month later. "I knew this the same way I found out about Tony when he made headlines on CNN. Our boy must care a lot about his hair," the stocky cop said from the bedroom doorway. Hauenzer sprayed the conditioner on his fingers. He sniffed at his hand and flinched away. Most cops I saw on TV wanted the spotlight and the attention. Hauenzer just wanted to put San Diego behind him. The last thing he needed was the media reminding him about his past. "You'd think with all that crap dripping off of his head, it would make him easier to find," the cop said. Problem is, no matter how hard Hauenzer tried to dodge the spotlight, it always managed to find him. He set the bottle back on the dresser, wiping his hand on his pants. "It's never easy. I learned that in San Diego." Hauenzer thought back to San Diego. Some kid had smoked a bunch of rival gang members, then turned on his own crew. The kid had left a trail of bodies that Hauenzer followed to a shithole apartment in Golden Hills. Hauenzer remembered how he had walked into that place, like walking into bedlam. Paramedics rushed to stabilize a baggy-clothed Mexican kid bleeding out through a gunshot wound in the side. He watched the grandmother fall to her knees in hysterics, clasp her hands together, beg and plead to God. Hauenzer knelt next to the kid and held the kid's hand. He knew he should have done more. He should have never let it get that far. If only he had caught up to Verse a little sooner. It was the same thing he had told the newspapers and networks when they interviewed him. He watched the paramedics try everything to save the kid, but nothing worked. They covered the kid's face with a sheet as the grandmother threw herself over the body, weeping. Verse. Hauenzer remembered the name like it was part of his daily vocabulary. He could never forget it. No matter how hard he tried, he couldn't get it out of his head, just like he still couldn't get San Diego completely out of his head. I knew this because he had confessed to all of it in the interviews. Word had come over the radio that they had caught up to the kid at a nearby liquor store. Hauenzer remembered the barricade of patrol cars that cordoned the liquor store parking lot. To his left and right were more than a dozen cops behind the cars, guns drawn and trained on the storefront. He aimed his Glock 22 at the baggy-clothed white kid standing inside the store entrance, gun in hand. A black baseball cap was tilted low on the kid's brow, the word Verse stitched in gold across the front. Hauenzer shouted over a megaphone at the kid to drop the gun, but the kid had a blank look on his face, stood there dazed like he didn't know what was going on. The kid suddenly darted back inside the store, shooting over his shoulder as he ran. He threw himself behind a shelf as bullets exploded all around him. The cops had followed Hauenzer into the store, but there was no sign of the kid except for drops of blood that led out of an open door and back. "I heard about that gang you took down out there," the stocky cop said. "HBK, right?" Hauenzer didn't answer. "So what does HBK stand for?" He He saw the kid's face veiled in shadows by the baseball cap. He closed his eyes for a second. When he opened them, the image was gone. The cop waited for Howenzer to answer, growing uneasy in the silence. "I also heard you almost quit the force after that," the cop finally said. Howenzer caught a glimpse of his reflection in the mirror and looked away. "You finished searching the house yet?" The cop focused back on the job at hand. "We found some guns in a floor safe in a closet in the next bedroom, 2 12-gauges, an AK-47, and a couple grand in the safe." Howenzer scanned around the room one last time. He turned his attention back to the cop. "What about the two in the Explorer?" "Artel followed him to some strip club on the west side." The cop glanced at his notepad. "A place called Stardust Lounge. They've been in there since." "You got an address?" "Yeah, right here." The cop tore a piece of paper out of the notepad. "The Explorer also matches the description of a vehicle involved in a hit-and-run on a police officer earlier tonight, right down to the bullet holes in the back end." Howenzer took the paper and glanced at it, walking to the doorway. The cop raised his hand as if for permission to ask a question. "Detective?" "Yeah, what is it?" Howenzer said over his shoulder. He stopped in the doorway. "You're Hispanic, right?" Howenzer faced the cop, the least bit amused. "Just what the hell is that supposed to mean?" "No, nothing." The cop was embarrassed now. "It's just that Howenzer isn't exactly a Hispanic name." "No, it isn't. My mother's Hispanic, my father's German-Russian," Howenzer said. The cop looked confused. Howenzer smirked, shaking his head. "Just stay here and wrap things up while I go check out the club." 11:57 p.m. Tony looked at the bullet of Chernobyl coke cupped in his palm. He was headed for Stardust Lounge. To this day, I still don't know if it was coincidence. His attention wandered from the road, mesmerized by the orange color. He dipped his pinky in for a taste, stuck the tip of his pinky into his nostril, and snorted. He tilted his head back, let the burn slide down his throat. He stared up at the night sky. The stars winked down at him and looked like cutouts on a piece of black construction paper, with a dull light shining through from behind. Glaring streetlights blotted out the sky as they passed overhead, leaving trails of harsh white light in their wake. "Shit!" Tony slammed on the brakes, and the Corvette screeched up to a vagrant hunched over a shopping cart in the middle of the street. Tony went heavy on the horn, but the old man didn't budge. Real fucking stupid. Tony backed up and drove around the bump. The old man's bloodshot eyes followed him. Tied to the side of the cart by string was a cardboard sign stained with grease spots. Large words scrawled in black marker read, "God forgives those who walk the path to redemption." "I should have hit him," Tony said. He lit a cigarette from his pack of Marlboros and had finished the smoke by the fifth drag. He went for another cigarette, but the pack was empty. He crumpled the pack in his hand, spotting the liquor store sign, NJ Liquor, looming in the quasi-light of the streetlights ahead. Tony parked the Corvette and rushed inside the store. He ordered a pack of Marlboros from the Iranian behind the counter, banging the counter to get the clerk to hurry. He threw his money on the counter, ran back to the car, and peeled out of the parking lot. I had stopped to take a piss in the alley and walked around to the front of the store. I stood in the store entrance, watching the Corvette speed away. "That's the trouble with the world today," I said to the Iranian. "Everybody's in a hurry." 12:04 a.m. Tony sat at the bar. He scanned around the stardust, ogling the blonde stripper on stage. Like I said, every strip joint was the same. "The lady at the end of the bar ordered this for you," the bartender set a shot down in front of Tony. "What's a chick doing in a titty bar?" Tony said. He downed the shot and chuckled. "Maybe she's into women or something." Every stripper had the same fake tits, same shaved cunts, the same shared stage names. Destiny with the tattoo on her lower back, Candy with the pierced belly button, Angel with the glitter eyeliner and fake lashes, Cherry, Raven, Anastasia, Roxy, Houston, Porsche, Chastity, Crystal. The list went on. They all had tattoos, glittery makeup, pierced tits, pierced clits, pierced navels. They all reeked of baby powder and cheap lotion. The plain strippers without the tattoos and piercings, they were special. Tony looked back at the blonde on stage. She was fully naked, shaved, with fake bouncy tits. The DJ announced her as Destiny. All the hair on her body was at the top of her head. She looked preteen at a distance, but up close she had mileage. Her lips hung out, red and puckered, stretched the way a pussy looks after having a kid, or one too many fistings. She had razor bumps from the shave. She swung around the dance pole, into a pole V, dropped down into a handspring split, that finished up with a pencil attitude. Her lips waved at all the pricks standing around the stage, and they waved back with dollar bills. The bartender pointed at Cynthia. "Why don't you go ask her?" There was nothing original about a strip club. Even the way the DJs announced the girls was the same. Sitting there with them, Tony fit right in. He glanced toward Cynthia, disinterested. When he saw her, his eyes lit up. "Let me know what you find out," the bartender said. The bartender served the other customers. Cynthia strutted over to Tony, wagging her hips and ass. "What's a pretty thing like you doing in a place like this?" Tony said. "Looking for a good time," Cynthia smiled. "My date went to buy cigarettes and stood me up." Only a grade-A asshole would leave such a pretty lady alone in a club full of men. You're in luck, though. You found me, and... Tony reached into his pocket. He took out the unopened pack of marbles. Ta-da! He patted the pack upside down to his palm a few times. He ripped off the cellophane, opened the pack, took out the first cigarette, and placed it back inside the pack right side up. For luck, he said. He held the pack for her as she pulled out a cigarette. It's not my brand, but it'll do, she said. She slipped the cigarette between her lips, using her tongue. Got a light? Tony reached back into his pocket for his lighter. He lit the cigarette. She took a long drag, blowing the smoke in his face. He stared at her mouth, at the dark red lipstick. She leaned over, whispered something into his ear, and he smiled. 12:09 a.m. Malcolm gagged in the barrel of the Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum shoved in his mouth. Big Papa cocked back the hammer, and Malcolm's eyes squinted into the back of his head. I want my money, Papa said. It didn't take long for Papa to find out about the raid. He squeezed gently on the trigger. A wide snarl spread across his face the way a bulldog growls for its supper. The top of his head glinted in the harsh white light of a streetlight behind a Burger King. It was a pig's, man. The cold steel of the gun barrel pressed against the inside of Malcolm's cheek. The pigs raided your shit. The fact Malcolm had tried to hit Papa up for more product didn't help. Malcolm probably figured he was trying to make things right. Then why you ain't in jail, huh? Papa jammed the gun harder into Malcolm's cheek. Too bad Papa wasn't the forgiving type. I wasn't in my house when they came, Malcolm said. Papa squeezed Malcolm's cheeks against the gun barrel before he could finish the sentence. I don't give a shit where you was, Malcolm. You owe me $50,000 and now it's time to pay up. Please, Papa, Malcolm latched onto Papa's black leather trench coat. Don't kill me, man. Get off me, greasy Jerry Crow motherfucker. Papa slapped Malcolm's hands away. What, you think you some special nigga that don't have to pay Big Papa back his ends? Ain't nothing free in Phoenix, chump. Ask Rob. He and Carl were at my pad right before the pig showed, Malcolm said. He held his breath, realizing what he said. Rob? What'd I tell you about him, huh? You been hooking that cracker up with free product again. Nah, man, it ain't like that. He paid this time. I swear, Papa, he paid. Shut the fuck up, Papa said. He smacked Malcolm in the face, pulling the gun out of his mouth. You said he bounced right before one time showed, right? Malcolm nodded his head yes. Shit, he probably the one that tipped them off. I know where he's at, Malcolm said. He's at that strip club on the west side, Stardust Lounge. All the years I knew Malcolm, it took him half that in seconds to sell me out. That still don't make up for the money you owe, Papa said. I'll get you your ends. I can get you the money. I would have probably done the same. Yeah? And how you gonna do that, huh? Malcolm stared past Papa, trying to think of something to say. Yeah, that's what I thought. Papa wiped the gun barrel on Malcolm's shirt. Come on, I know how you can pay me back. Papa motioned with the 357 toward a brown Lexus LS430 parked nearby in the Burger King parking lot. Malcolm hurried to the passenger side door. His eyes followed the 357 pointed at him. I'll do whatever it takes, Malcolm dried his eyes. Whatever you want, I'll do it. Yeah, I know you will. You ain't got no other choice, Papa said. The Lexus sped north through South Phoenix. The nightlife raced by. It slowed and sped up, slowed again to catch back up. Malcolm's mind was on other things, mostly the 357 and Papa's hand. Everything else was peripheral, a blur of light and motion. Where are we going? Malcolm finally said. You said Rob's at Stardust Lounge, right? Yeah, he's there, Papa, I swear. There's a liquor store near there I used to own. Papa tossed a cell phone onto Malcolm's lap. We're going to make us a little withdrawal. 12:11 a.m. NJ Liquor was further up the street than the bartender had said. I took my time walking back. I snorted another bump of Chernobyl Coke out of one of the bullets I had kept for myself. The back of my throat was raw from the burn, then numb and tingling. My head felt light, like it wanted to float away. I speed-walked into the Stardust, up to the bar. George Clinton's atomic dog blared over the loudspeakers. I looked around for Cynthia, but she was gone, and I flagged down the bartender. You know what happened to that girl I was with? I think you missed your chance, he pointed to the men's bathroom. She disappeared into the bathroom with some other guy. You fucking kidding, I said. The bartender shrugged. Carl's cell phone vibrated in my pocket. I checked the phone but didn't recognize the number. Yo, speak. Rob, it's Malcolm. When Malcolm answered on the other end, I knew something was up. You still at Stardust Lounge? Yeah, I said. You changed your mind about joining us? Yeah, but I got some business I need to discuss with you first. Malcolm told me he had re-upped with Papa for $50,000 of the Chernobyl Coke. He didn't want to talk about it at the club. Where then? I said. Meet me at NJ Liquor. It's right there on the corner of Dunlap and 43rd, southeast corner. Yeah, I know where it's at, I said. If I help Malcolm sell the coke, Papa will clear our debts. You hear that? Malcolm said, tapping the phone. No, what? That's opportunity knocking. Cut the shit, man, I said. So if we do this, Papa said we're straight? Paid in full. You in? I thought about it. I still wanted to go legit. My debt to Papa was the only thing holding me back. If I was going to make a fresh start, I needed to pay him back, and this was a second chance dropped right in my lap. "Yeah, I'm in," I said. I wish I had never answered the phone. Ground zero, back where I started, staring up at those bathroom lights. I had waited for Cynthia to come out of the men's bathroom. 18 minutes and I was still waiting. The noise died down between songs and techno blared through the club a second later. I waded through the crowd to the bathroom. Part of me wished I was in that stall with Cynthia. I inched open the bathroom door, looked up at the lights, and cringed. The other part of me knew if I was in that stall, I would have fallen for her in a bad way. The techno stopped, and Burning Down the House by the Talking Heads played over the loudspeakers next. I crept out of the bathroom, letting the door slam shut. "Let me get another Corona," I sat back down at the bar. "I take it she was busy," the bartender said. He set the Corona on the bar. "Fucking cocktease. Put this one on my tab, too." "Don't worry about it. It's on the house." "Thanks, man. I guess you were right." I turned to watch the strippers on stage. Looks like I missed my chance. 12:30 a.m. Cynthia heard the bathroom door slam. She lifted her head out of Tony's lap. "What was that?" she spit on the floor. "Did you hear that?" I knew Tony wasn't the first prick she had blown. He wasn't the first, just like she wasn't my first. "Hear what?" Tony said. He pulled up his pants. Cynthia stood and cracked open the stall door. She looked around. Disgusted with herself, she walked to the sinks, rinsing out her mouth in the sink. "Relax," Tony slid his arms around her from behind. "See, there's no one else here. It's just you and me." Every guy wants to believe when he hooks up with a girl, he's sealed the deal. He fucks her, then moves on to the next. It never occurs to him, or he doesn't want to acknowledge, that she's capable of the same, even after it happens. Cynthia tensed. She looked at Tony's reflection in the mirror. "I don't even know your name." "That's what happened to me, only I didn't get the chance to fuck her." "Tony, what's yours?" he said. "Iris Kelly," she smiled. He went to kiss her on the neck, but she wiggled out of his arms and pushed him away. "What's wrong?" "Nothing." Annoyed, he let her go. He reached into his pocket. "You aren't a narc or anything?" "No," she smiled. "Just making sure. You can never be too careful." Tony took the bullet of Chernobyl Coke out of his pocket. "You mind if I do some of this in front of you?" "Only if you share." Tony packed a hit into the chamber. He turned the lever, locked the valve upright, and snorted the bump. His eyes teared up like he just got punched in the nose. He pinched the ridge of his nose with his fingers. "You okay?" Cynthia said. The burn passed and Tony waved Cynthia off. She leaned into him, dragging her finger down his stomach to his crotch. "Is it my turn yet?" Tony dangled the bullet in front of Cynthia as he led her back into the stall. "What are you going to do for it?" He sat down on the toilet lid. "Whatever you want," she said, and snatched the bullet. She loaded a hit, snorted it, loaded and snorted two more. "Take it easy with that shit." Cynthia knelt between his legs. "Don't worry," she said. She bit at the crotch of his pants. "I handle my drugs like I handle a big dick." Tony held her by the arms and carefully pushed her head out of his lap. Cynthia looked up at him, smiling, high as a kite. Her cheeks were flush, red and inflamed like a hard slap in the face. Her eyes were glassy and enormous. She started unscrewing the top of the bullet. "Don't overdo it," he said. He reached for the bullet. She jerked away and stuck her nose over the vial. She sucked up the rest of the powder in one giant snort. "Greedy bitch," Tony snatched her arms and shook her. "What did I say, huh?" Cynthia put her head between her hands like a vise. Her eyes fluttered, then rolled up into her head. Tony smacked Cynthia in the face to snap her out of it. She tipped backward into the stall door. Her weight knocked the door open and she fell face first across the floor. Her miniskirt flipped up over her ass. Tony jumped to his feet. He noticed she wasn't wearing panties. He turned her over onto her back. Blood had drained out of her nose, over her lips. A trail of vomit ran from her mouth down the front of her blouse. He looked to the spot on the floor where her mouth was, where the blood and vomit had pooled. "Nice, Iris. Real fucking nice," he said. He knelt down and smacked her in the face again. "Iris, get up. Wake the fuck up." He touched her chest. "Ah, shit. You're not breathing. She's not fucking breathing." The music stopped. Tony looked to the bathroom door. He heard heavy footsteps outside the bathroom. He lifted Cynthia by the arms and dragged her toward the stall. The door opened and the chunky black man who was a cross between Biggie Smalls and a black Buddha paused in the doorway. "Don't lose that position, baby," the man said, his attention on the stage. "Daddy's gonna be back as soon as he handles his business." Time slowed and stills. Tony's feet glued to the floor as the black man's head swiveled in Tony's direction. At 2 grams of Chernobyl coke, between 1.2 to 1.5 grams in her system, times one empty bullet in his possession, plus the fact he was caught dragging her into the stall, Tony was looking at 10 to 15 years of hard time. 10 years from now, I pictured Tony bent over a cot getting ass-pounded by the black man, face suffocated in a mottled pillow, screaming and gagging on the sour smell. Standing there, holding Cynthia by the arms, I think Tony pictured the same. His feet unglued, she suddenly felt light, filled with air like a blow-up doll. He heaved her into the stall, and for a second, he thought maybe she was filled with air. She sailed across the floor, floated down onto the toilet, facing him, her mouth an O waiting for insertion. He looked again and she collapsed over the toilet, her head hitting the porcelain with a loud smack. The black man walked into the bathroom. He stepped up to a urinal and unzipped. Tony leaned against the stall door, watching him. "What the fuck you looking at, cracker?" the man said. "Who, me?" Tony looked away. He was nervous, covered in sweat. "Nothing." The man pissed what sounded like a large pitcher of water. He gave his dick a hearty shake and zipped up. "Next time, cracker, I catch you staring so hard, I'll make you handle it for me," he spit on the floor. "Punk-ass motherfucker." The black man threw open the bathroom door and walked out. "Fucking nigger," Tony said. "What a night." Tony opened the stall door and looked in at Cynthia. The song "The End" by the Doors eased over the loudspeakers, muffled by the bathroom walls. She was slumped over the toilet, doggy style, propped up by the toilet, her legs spread apart at an awkward angle. Tony wiped the sweat from his face with his sleeve and slid his hand down over his crotch. She wasn't shaved, but he could tell she had kept it trimmed. Her lips had loosened open between her legs. He stared at her ass, her pussy, and entered the stall, closing the door behind him. 12:11 a.m., 20 minutes earlier. The unmarked police cruiser sped through downtown Phoenix. Hounzer rolled down the window, and the cool night air washed over his face. He looked out at the streets, watching the nightlife race by. He saw the hookers along Van Buren Street, the 5 white cops, guns drawn, that rushed a souped-up Fast and Furious Honda Civic with 2 Mexican teens holding their hands out of the windows, the bums that pushed their shopping carts, rooted through dumpsters, and huddled asleep inside bus stops or under storefront awnings, the long lines that hugged the outside of El Capri nightclub, Mexican cowboys in bolo ties and white Stetsons, sexy Latinas in tight dance dresses, Mexican teens and 20-somethings in the latest hip-hop fashions, the Impala 4 gangbangers deep that prowled the streets, the gangbangers that loitered the Baja Market liquor store payphone. The nightlife slowed and sped up, slowed again to catch back up, but Hauenzer's mind had drifted to other things. He saw a kid tag a wall, and he thought back to Verse and HBK. He remembered how he had tracked Verse to a small, Pueblo-style house painted in cheap whitewash slapped over stucco. He remembered the light on in the kitchen, how he had crept up the steps to the front porch, pushed on the front door, and how it had creaked open. Hauenzer had peered inside from the side of the front door. The light from the kitchen spilled out into the living room through an open doorway. An ugly brown couch, the color of shit, sat next to the kitchen doorway. To the left, in front of the couch, sat a 1976 Magnavox TV console with a few dead, dried-up potted plants spaced across the top. The whitewashed walls were dirty and marked up, hung with oil-painted replicas of a Huichol yarn painting and a Mexican retablos of the Virgin de Guadalupe. He inched up to the open doorway, peered around the corner into the kitchen, but no one was there. Something moved at the back of the house. Hauenzer looked across the living room to a dark hallway and the master bedroom and back. He edged down the hallway toward the bedroom, gun trained on the doorway, pausing between steps. He stopped short of the doorway as if waiting for something to happen. There was a slap and a stifled cry from inside the room. Hauenzer glanced into the room and saw Verse with his back to the door. Verse still wore the same black baseball cap tilted low on his brow, with his name stitched in gold across the front. He pointed a Springfield 9mm at a bound and gagged mother and teenage son, kneeling in front of him near a bed in vanity. "It's all over, kid." "You know I didn't want it to end this way," Verse said over his shoulder. "It doesn't have to unless you let it. You still have a chance to do the right thing," Hauenzer said. He reached out his free hand for Verse to give him the gun. "All you have to do is give me the gun." Verse tensed on the trigger. "Nah, fuck that. It's too late for that shit now. Don't you think I tried? I was through with the streets." But somehow it knew. "What knew?" Hauenzer said. "The demon. It was with me all along. I tried to resist, but deep down it knew there was still a part of me that didn't want to leave the streets. That faggot Billy kept pushing. Them putos Pushu and Mister kept pushing. So did them little motherfuckers from SFA. They didn't take me seriously, didn't respect me. They just kept pushing and pushing until I gave in to the demon and smoked them all one by one." "You're wrong, kid," Hauenzer said. "It's just a hallucination. None of it's real. You still have a way out if you give me the gun." Verse pointed the gun at the teenage son. "No, I had my chance. My way out was right here. You were my friend, Holmes. My only real friend," he said to the teen. The teen struggled against the bonds, trying to speak through the gag. "You said you were going to help me get off the streets. You promised, man, and I believed you." He shoved the gun in the mother's face, and she screamed. "But your bitch moms had to get in the way and fuck everything up. Now it's too late." Now I'm just a hell-bound kid. Don't do this, Hauenzer said. Don't be another statistic. Another statistic? Verse looked over his shoulder. He stared long and hard into Hauenzer's eyes. He tightened his grip on the gun. That's all I ever was.
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.